Nathaniel Johnson grew up in the kind of house where kids ate lots of kale and brown rice, played outside in the woods, and sang together before dinner. His parents tried to raise the kids in a natural way, and for a long time he thought that was the best way. But sometimes questions popped up.
When I was a little kid, I think this was, I was 8 or 9 at this point, my parents broke down and got a computer, and it was this amber-screened IBM clone, and this was just like a magical thing entering into our lives because we didn't have a TV, and our house was so Spartan when it came to technology, and so we just gravitated to this, my little brother and I, and my parents insisted that we, you know, it would kill us, it would rot our brains, and we couldn't come close. But then my dad kind of got interested in that there were these games you could play on the computer, and he got a game called Space Quest, and they said, look, it's really unfair if dad is playing these games that the kids can't play the computer games. So the deal that they struck was that we could play half an hour on the computer for every 3 hours that we spent outside. And so this brings us to me and my brother huddled outside the back door of our house on this freezing day while sleet is coming down. And we are just doing everything that we can to get our little half hour of computer time. And my little brother Tim has this mobile clock with him, and we're under this big dirty blanket. And it's just so cold. And every once in a while, I'll ask Tim, okay, how much longer do we have? And he'll say, well, that's been 8 minutes. And this was one of those moments where I was thinking, gosh, you know, is it really healthier for us to be outside in the rain as opposed to inside in front of this nice, warm computer? That was sort of the first really conscious grappling with nature versus technology.
Johnson's a journalist whose work has appeared in Harper's, New York Magazine, California Watch, and on This American Life, as well as this very program on KALW. He's also a new father with a newly personal stake in figuring out how to live well. So he set about trying to locate the truth he thought might lie between the unquestioning acceptance of the all-natural and slavish devotion to the modern. The result is the new book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. So you talk about ecological anxiety. What do you mean by that term?
Well, I think all of us these days, or at least any of us that has a conscience.
And pretty much all of us here in the Bay Area, right?
Right, and certainly anybody listening to public radio has kind of this level of background anxiety for every moment in our lives. When you're in the grocery store trying to choose between the conventional and the organic head of lettuce. And, well, does it make sense if it's a dollar more or if it's a $1.50? And what are the implications of my choice, both for myself and for my entire society?
And for the planet.
Yes, exactly.
And ever since I read your book, I've noticed how many labels say all natural without any clue about what that means.
Yeah, and it doesn't really mean anything. But it's the fastest growing, last time I checked at least, the fastest growing tag on new products.
And so you wrote this book partly based on your own childhood and your parents' endeavors to raise you in this kind of all-natural environment. So can you tell us about growing up in Nevada City, California, which is a town that has kind of this duality that you talk about in the book, which is, you know, kind of the back-to-nature hippies and then the redneck loggers.
Right. And I think there's a lot of these small towns in California that have this duality. Nevada City is a place that a lot of people in the late 60s moved up to from the Bay Area. Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg bought a plot of land up there, and a lot of people then followed those poets. And so there is this contingent of bohemian artists. There's spiritual communities up there. And then there's also the people that were there beforehand, people who were working in lumber and working in the mines. There were gold mines there, and just the Republican businessmen that kind of formed the background of the old school party politics in that area.
And so that town maybe informed this duality that is the center of your book, the kind of science and modern progress on one hand, and this reverence of nature and desire to live a natural life.
Exactly. Yeah. I had this image from my parents and from their friends of the natural way. And that's really tenderly wedded to my sense of childhood innocence. I have a lot of sympathy for that. But then as I got older, I started seeing these other friends out there that had these beautiful kitchens with sub-zero fridges in them. I don't know if they were sub-zero, but whatever the equivalent
was. And who were allowed
to
eat sugar.
In those fridges, oh my goodness, the wonders in those fridges. There were Capri Suns, and there were Lunchables, and just amazing things, and ice cream. And I really started, this shook my faith in my parents' ideology. And I really started to wonder, is this really good, or is this maybe actually doing me harm?
This all natural approach.
Right.
And so did grappling with these questions become more acute when you knew you were going to be a father?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that I'd always had this duality in my head, and I'd sort of float one way or float the other. But when you have a kid, it forces you to put your ideals into practice. You really have to nail things down and say, okay, this is what we're going to do with the kid being allowed to have sugar. This is how we're going to, this is the place we're going to choose to have birth in. Are we going to let this creature watch television or not? And so I all of a sudden felt this sense of urgency to make a choice in between one of, or the other of these ways of being, the natural or the technological, using technology to protect myself against nature. And so that was really the energy behind the book.
So you write in your book about modern medicine, farming, environmental devastation. I was hoping we could look at some of these cases that you examine in the creation of this book. You looked into pig farming as one of the things, and the way that we've created these huge factory farms to keep up with consumer demand for cheap food. And I was interested to hear about the perspective that you give from the farmer's perspective and from the executive's perspectives, all of whom said, we've taken this kind of technological approach to farming way too far. So explain what you found out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they would use those exact words. But there is a recognition that that the technological advancement, they've really reshaped the body of the pig, has been pushed to such extremes that there's need for some modification.
And you say that the way that they've done it in pig farming is to kind of get technological advancement after technological advancement, some of which are fixing a problem like too much, excrement,
right?
So artificial insemination,
right? So this all started for me when I was working as a reporter in Burley, Idaho, this little town in southern Idaho, and I had a friend there. I had one friend. I had a couple friends, but it was such a tiny town that I didn't know many people, and I was kind of lonely. And one of my friends was telling me over a beer about her work, which was inseminating pigs.
Say that again, because I'm not sure that everybody can get it the first time. Her job was to artificially inseminate pigs.
Yeah, and I didn't get it the first time. She was just complaining about, you know, she's drinking her beer at the bar, and she's like, gosh, it was a hard day at work today. The sows just trampled me a couple times, you know. You really got to get in there and rub them sometimes, and sometimes they go berserk. And I said, wait a second, what exactly is your job? And after I learned that this is how our bacon gets pregnant, I really wanted to know why. What's the chain of events that's led to this kind of bizarre practice.
That you're not using the natural practice that works so well in most cases, right?
It tends to work pretty well. It tends to work too well for some of us. And I saw that there was this whole history of making little changes to improve pork production or to make pigs skinnier or to make them grow faster. And then that change would cause a problem. And so there would be another technological fix to address that problem. As pigs, they made pigs skinnier and faster growing, they also became more similar and more susceptible to disease. So they had to be put inside in these biosecure barns. And in these barns, they would fight. And so they had to be separated in little cages. And the substances they were giving these pigs to make sure that they put on a lot of muscly bulk really quickly made them a little bit crazy, and so crazy that sometimes they would simply keel over and die if they had a shock. And so then there's further technological fixes to these things. And so there's this whole kind of tower of fix upon fix upon fix. So it's really hard to ask, to stop and ask if maybe we should just go back and see if these technological interventions make sense in the first place, if we should go back to doing things in a simpler way.
And when you found farmers who were doing that, what were their dilemmas?
Well, there are farmers doing that. There's some very big Nyman Ranch farms does things in a much simpler way.
And there's a demand for that kind of food, right?
Absolutely. There's a huge demand. Chipotle is supplied by Nyman Ranch pork. The issue is that there's always this pressure to produce more and produce it more cheaply. And that pressure comes from us, the consumer, and the farmers feel that. And they're always pushed toward a way that's less humane for the animals.
And Nate, your book is full of these paradoxes of kind of scientific advancements versus going back and looking at the way that we've done things for centuries and millennia and trying to balance that duality. And one of the things that you find, two things I'd like to bring up, that, you know, dieting seems to be making us fatter.
Right.
And why would that be? And despite all of the advances in medical science, we're getting sicker.
Right. So, okay, so dieting makes us fatter. The standard story of our civilization is we're trying to escape from nature. We're rolling the rocks in front of our caves so the saber-toothed tigers can't get in, and technology protects us from nature. In a fundamental sense, this is true, and this is what we believe. But then these paradoxes do crop up where our technological ways that we're trying to protect ourselves actually end up backfiring and producing the opposite results that we want. So it's interesting to look at the fact that only in cultures where we have an understanding of food science do we have obesity and diabetes and heart disease at endemic levels. That really doesn't make any sense. And it seems to be that what we know about nutrition is really just the tip of the iceberg. And we've made a lot of huge changes in our cultural patterns of eating based on a very small amount of data. And it's been a catastrophe, frankly.
And do you think that that's in part because we've taken this scientific approach to something that is pleasure? I mean, to something that if you spend time cooking with people, sharing a meal together, that there's something about that in and of itself that is the satisfying thing about eating to some degree. That it isn't just putting the nutrients in your body necessarily.
Right. Well, there are these two different ways of looking at nutrition. You know, you can ask, would you rather know precisely what nutrient components are in your food, or would you like to just not really know? And you know, maybe you know the ingredients, but you don't really know what's in those ingredients. And maybe there's bacteria and other things that could kill you, possibly. I think most of us would say, well, of course, I'd want to know. But when you look at it from a broad, more human perspective and say, you know, do you want this tube of processed cheese food or do you want this farmhouse cheese that, yeah, you don't know everything that's in it, but people have been eating it for millennia and have been thriving on it. And moreover, more importantly, when you taste it, it just lights up your brainstem and everything is good in the world. Then I think people answer the question precisely the opposite way. And we've become so abstracted from our basic sensation and trusting in what makes us feel good, not just what makes us crave, but what brings us a kind of holy joy in eating. And so we trust the numbers on the nutrition label more than we trust our own senses. And I think that that's a problem. At least it's a problem right now when we have such an imperfect understanding of how nutrition really works.
And you really delved into some of how things really do work. You looked into vaccines and you looked into the healthcare system. And one of the things that you found looking into the way that childbirth happens with modern medicine is that maternal mortality, the rate of women dying in childbirth actually started to spike.
Yes.
So, in the 90s, I think it was, right?
No, in this decade.
In this decade.
Yeah, this was research that I began here, actually, working as a reporter at KLW. And this really surprised me that when you look at a graph of maternal mortality rates, women dying in childbirth across the last century, it looks like someone falling off a mountain. I mean, it starts incredibly high and then it just drops to really low levels in the modern era. And so it's indisputable that our technological advances in obstetrics has saved millions of lives. But now something's going wrong, and that progress is eroding. And the reporting that I did here and that I continued with this book was really trying to figure out what were the causes of that erosion of the maternal mortality rate. And in the U.S., we're already not doing so well with birth. You know, infant mortality rates were lagging behind other developed nations as well. For maternal mortality, we're tied with Belarus. And I don't know if I trust the Belarusian statisticians, but the point is that we should be tied with England or something, and we're just not.
So what did you find? What are some of the causes?
Well, this is an area of tremendous debate in the medical field. And the suspects are an increase in C-sections, increase in obesity, diabetes, and older women giving birth. And it's probably all of these things at once. And unfortunately, what tends to dominate the airspace is does the increase in medicalization, is that anything, or is it all these other nutritional and social problems that are going on? And we know that at least some of the women who are dying from complications that are related directly to cesarean section. So I think we need to address all of these problems, and we need to address them. The problem, I think, is that the solutions that are being proposed, there's some amazing things happening in hospitals around the country. People understand that this is a problem and they're on it. But the solutions that are being proposed are primarily reactive. It's getting all the employees in the hospital together to do drills for when a woman has a hemorrhage. It's making sure that the blood banks are big enough to deal with these catastrophic situations. It's making sure that every woman has compression stockings on after a C-section so that she doesn't get a blood clot forming in her leg. It's more medicine on top of medicine. And I think that to address these problems, we've really got to be proactive, and we've got to look at, can we prevent some of these C-sections? Can we do something to prevent obesity and heart disease? Can we do something so that it's easier for women to give birth earlier in life rather than feeling like they have to completely trade away their professional life for a family. That's the level where we could really see substantive change. You know, these are problems that should be addressed by politicians and at the family dinner table, not at the operating table.
So how did you take all of this research into maternal mortality and into childbirthing practices? Because you looked at midwifery and all of these different ways. How did you translate that into your own life? What did you choose, a home birth or a hospital birth?
Well, it was kind of a conflict because I was born at home and that was my sense of normal. And I had some skepticism for that as well, because in this research, I found that my mother had a hemorrhage afterwards. And for a few really terrifying moments, my father thought that she might die. And I only learned that when I started asking them the hard questions later on. They just told me the sunny side. And then my wife came from a very different background. She came from a much more conventional family, East Coast Republicans that are into sailing and conservative, fiscal conservatism, you know. And she was born via scheduled cesarean section. It was medically indicated, but she, you know, just had never thought about this stuff. And the idea of giving birth at home was terrifying for her. And so we talked about that, and I realized very quickly that I didn't have a leg to stand on, you know, both mostly because she was going to be the one doing it, but also because my research had showed that the way a woman feels is really important during childbirth.
And it's something that we've kind of thrown out with modern medicine a lot. A woman is a problem to be solved.
Right. Yeah. I think the way people feel, unfortunately, modern medicine doesn't really pay that much attention to feelings anymore. And it's really a problem because feelings are an important part of what makes us sick and what makes us well. But the same hormones that make us feel at ease and happy are some of the hormones that are important during birth. And so it's very important for a woman to feel comfortable during birth. And where Beth was going to feel comfortable, my wife, Beth, is in a hospital.
And so you put that ahead of everything else.
Yeah. And we ended up going to a hospital a few blocks away from us. And I sort of felt like we were just doing the default. I was getting incorporated into the sausage factory, but it was also a very lovely place. They have at St. Luke's, it's a program that's headed by midwives. And we just kind of fell in love with all of the people that we met there.
And the Bay Area is a place that is trying to marry some of the old sciences, the caring sciences, with modern practices. One of the things that you write in your book, it's more important than ever for the medical system to combine technical excellence and empathetic wisdom, because the bulk of the ills affecting Americans are not sicknesses that can be cured, but chronic problems.
Right.
And maybe that's one of the paradoxes that we're talking about of, you know, we've got more scientific advancement than ever before, more nutritional science, and yet we're sicker, unhealthier, fatter, more depressed.
You know, when you look at these problems from a narrowly focused perspective that's just looking at the numbers and how can we improve things, looking at just these few numbers, the numbers that we tend to look at are cost, are the bottom line. And when you do that, a lot of things get missed. It makes it really easy to make goals and push toward those goals, but you simplify. You push out beauty. You push out happiness. You push out everything that makes life worth
living. Clean air.
Yeah.
Clean water. Well, you give a really good example of this, a fight over the forests in Nevada City or around Nevada City where you grew up. And you talk about the sort of preservationists were in conflict with those who wanted to harvest the timber, and that these communities were actually able to come together and find a solution. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, this is kind of an amazing story, actually. So this goes back to those two groups in Nevada City, the kind of hippie aspect and the more conservative lumberers and those folks. And there was a proposal to trade away some of the Bureau of Land Management forest up there and trade it to a big timber company that would come in and harvest it. And Gary Snyder and a bunch of people that live near him petitioned to stop this. And the guy that that petition came to was a Bureau of Land Management official named Dean Swickard. And this was not your average government bureaucrat. This was a Marine pilot who had just come back from Vietnam. And he was a really remarkable guy. He had gotten to this position. He'd risen up through the ranks in almost record speed. And he was now an administrator, but he didn't want to be a desk jockey. He said, you know, I've got this job, but I'm going to look the people in the eye and I'm going to touch the ground that I'm taking care of. And so he actually goes up to the San Juan Ridge just outside of Nevada City and meets with these folks who are all upset, and some of them are wearing Birkenstocks and talking about the spirit of the trees, and
the other and many others just want that tree to become lumber,
right? And but he also saw, Dean Swickard also saw, that a lot of these folks were really intelligent, scientifically minded people that he could work with, and he said, let's cut a deal. If you guys, instead of just trying to stop every single thing that I do, if you can come up with a plan to cooperatively manage this land, then I'll back you. And if it makes sense, if it's a plan that isn't just about putting an end to all industry, but actually can serve the mandates of the BLM, then we'll make it happen. And they did. It took a really long time. It was incredibly frustrating. They had meetings for, I think, 6 years. But eventually they came up with this plan to manage the forest, and the BLM accepted it. And the idea was basically that they would grow big trees fast and then harvest those trees in a very selective, scientifically-minded way, so as to both improve the habitat and make a lot of money, because when you sell big trees, you can really get a premium.
So this was kind of high quality wood as well.
Yeah, high quality timber and high quality habitat.
And then they were also managing the forest to mitigate forest fires, right?
Right, because one of the problems that you've seen in California is that there's been such a ban on lumbering in national forests. It's just starting to come back a little bit, but the environmental movement did such a good job of shutting things down that there's actually been a little bit of it's caused some problems with the fire load and with the amount of timber that's on there. These forests do need to have fires move through them once in a while. They do need some management, or else they get just incredibly choked with brush and with wood, and it can be really catastrophic. And we've just seen year after year the cost of managing the fires going up. It's going up because of global warming in part, but also because we haven't done a really rational job of managing these forests.
And managing this duality that you're talking about.
Exactly.
And so the example of Nevada City is where people from very diametrically opposed points of view were able to come together and find a solution that worked for everyone.
I mean, people still fight like crazy. Don't get me
wrong. There's not total harmony in Nevada City
No.
now.
And, you know, they're working on actually one of their first real, one of their larger timber harvests right now. And there's still people out there who are like, you know, don't even think that you should cut down a single piece of brush because that messes with nature's way. So that fight continues. But what was really heartening to me is this idea that nature's industry and human industry could exist in the same place, and that you could have a form of nature that's supporting us and is still beautiful, and there's still room for the animals as well, because environmentalism just seems so hopeless when it's saving these last little jewels from our ever-expanding gullet.
And one of the questions you say is, paradoxes are the wrinkles where the cloth of belief does not fit the shape of things as they truly are. I believe that explains our paralysis in the face of environmental decline. So after doing all of this research, after coming to these conclusions, after trying to marry these two parts of your own self and your own brain, how do you think we can break this paralysis and begin to kind of preempt ecological disaster, which we're literally on the brink of? So
I think the first step is to realize that we're not on the brink of it. We're in it. And this idea that there is apocalypse coming, I think, is part of the problem, that it's not that there's going to be some huge tipping point and everything is all of a sudden going to change, and then all of the doomsayers will be able to stand up and shake their fists and say, "I told you so." No, it's just our lives are going to get harder gradually, and we're already seeing this. We're already having to pay a lot of money to pump water out of the New York subway systems, and just stupid things that we wouldn't have to be paying money for because we didn't have the foresight. And I think, you know, if it's this idea of imminent apocalypse, it can just seem so helpless.
And overwhelming. How can I take action in the face of apocalypse?
Right. The only rational thing to do is to tune it out. And I think that's a big part of the problem. You know, I went from feeling very helpless because you either tune it out or you move to a shack in the woods like my parents did. I mean, it wasn't a shack. It was a nice house. But we were trying to sort of separate ourselves from society and get back to
nature. Yeah.
And that paradoxically made me feel more helpless, because if the only way to fix this problem is to convert everyone to my ascetic way of life, or to cause revolution and sort of overthrow civilization, that's a big ask. And instead, when the solution has to do with simply being part of your society and making these small tinkering tweaks to make the part of your society that you can touch a little bit better, that really gives me some hope.